The Tom Woods Show, episode 2282.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, chances are if you're listening to this podcast, you are surrounded by irrational, panicked people who think you're a terrible person because you don't want to lock everybody in their houses. No amount of reasoning appears to accomplish anything. And not to mention the media has done nothing but stoke fear and failed to provide context. Well, one of the many benefits you get as a supporter of The Tom Woods Show is membership inside The Tom Woods Show Elite. Recently migrated off Facebook, so if that was holding you back, no longer. This group will keep you sane and informed, and as an added bonus, it won't accuse you of wanting to kill your grandmother. Join me in there at supportinglisteners.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I am delighted to welcome Mark Bailey to the show. Before I bring Mark on, I want to set the stage here a little bit. I realize that the title of this episode is quite provocative, but I'm at the point now where I'm willing to talk to any intelligent person who has something potentially of value to say and not be intimidated by people telling me, well, there's only one side to this discussion, or you can't talk to such and such person, or I refuse to debate such and such topic. The people in the establishment, whether it's the health establishment or the political establishment or whatever, have used that kind of intimidation tactic just one too many times. So I'm just not going for it anymore. And I'll tell you something. I, in response to my email newsletter over the past few years, have gotten more and more people saying to me, you've got to talk to one of the following people. And Dr. Mark Bailey is one of those people who is skeptical of virology itself, not just this or that application or whether the cycle threshold is too high in the PCR test. We're talking way beyond that. Somebody who argues that virology itself rests on highly dubious assumptions, to put it mildly. And so maybe Mark Bailey's wrong about this, but if he is wrong, I would welcome somebody who is knowledgeable in this field to come back on and have a civil conversation about it. But in the meantime, yeah, I'm willing to let a dissident voice be heard. And Mark Bailey, you are, as you are well aware, a dissident voice. So first of all, welcome to the Tom Woods Show.
Thank you very much, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
You're coming to us all the way from New Zealand, so it's oddly enough already tomorrow where you are. Would you mind starting off by giving us a little bit of your background and the circumstances behind your leaving the formal practice of medicine and moving more into research?
Sure, yeah. Well, a lot of people will know my other half, Dr. Sam Bailey, who has pretty large platforms on the internet since 2020. And both of us were conventionally trained doctors. I graduated in 1999. I was in the system for approximately two decades until my departure in 2016. And I worked in a number of fields, including clinical research as a supervising research physician, and as well as a number of specialties, largely hospital-based, towards the end of my practice, also in private practice settings. In 2016, my dissatisfaction with allopathic medicine reached the point where I no longer wanted to be a part of it. I didn't think it was based on sound science, and I really wasn't happy with the practice that I was involved with. So when I exited in 2016, I had no intention of getting involved with any medical practice or research or anything, and I thought that was the end of it. My wife, Sam, did continue in medicine. She had a research job that she really enjoyed and wanted to continue doing that. And then we came through to 2019, end of 2019. And there was this talk of a new, quote, virus coming out of China. Perhaps a pandemic was going to happen. And Sam and I started looking into some of the research that was coming out, the initial research, or more at that stage, it was consensus statements from the WHO and other institutions. And we got a really bad feeling about it because the more we looked into it, the more we realized there was not a lot of evidence to what they were saying. And it seemed to be authorities like WHO, the CDC, various ministries of health were just making these statements. And when you search for any citations or backing scientific evidence, you just couldn't find it. So by early 2020, Sam was actually a, it's hard to believe now, but she was a mainstream TV presenter here in New Zealand on a medical show. And she'd also started a YouTube channel. And people started asking her to look into COVID-19 in this alleged brewing pandemic. And by early 2020, we realized that there were major, major problems with the quote science that was being cited, including all of those original papers that started coming out of Wuhan, claiming that there was this particle called SARS-CoV-2, that it was infectious, that it was going around the world, making people sick, etc. And our investigations basically led us to the point where we went very deep into virology, starting in 2020, and came to the realization that there was no evidence whatsoever that particles called viruses actually existed. Now, to us, that was a shock because obviously we had both been conventional doctors in the system. We thought we were seeing patients who had, quote, viral illnesses. We thought we were treating them, all that kind of stuff. But we realized that the whole thing was built up on pseudoscientific fallacies, been propagated by the pharmaceutical industry, by various institutions around the world that are allied with the pharmaceutical industry. And yeah, that's basically how we got to where we are today. And just, I mean, it's probably good to say this early, Tom, is that this is not something casual that we've done. This is an incredibly deep investigation. And all of our work is based at drsambailey.com. So we're talking hundreds of videos, articles, extensive essays, et cetera, numerous interviews detailing how we've reached this position.
And in fact, it was one of those videos that one of my listeners sent to me that made me decide, all right, I surrender. I'm going to talk to Mark Bailey. I surrender, everybody. Let's do it. Now, again, this is not a health podcast. It's not a medical podcast, not a scientific podcast. So to some degree, in speaking to us as laymen, probably you're going to wind up oversimplifying something. Everybody understands that. Can you just start by explaining simply what the mainstream view of virology is? What exactly would they say a virus is? And how do they think they know that they are in the presence of such a virus or that they have, quote unquote, isolated such a virus?
Yeah, well, this is the major problem, because even if you ask people within the medical community what a virus is, it's actually quite interesting to hear their responses, because many of them do not really seem to know. So over the years, the concept of the virus was sort of invented around the late 1800s when germ theory was developing. And back then, it was just called like a fluid contagion. They thought there was something being transmitted, but they couldn't see it, obviously. And then by the early 1900s, they thought it was some sort of infectious protein that was passing around. And then by about the 1950s, it took on the more modern conception, which is this tiny little particle with a protein-type shell containing genetic material, which could be DNA or RNA, depending on what, quote, virus they claim they're talking about. And the particle was supposed to be replication competent. So it's supposed to be able to go into a host cell, and the result is supposed to be millions and billions of copies get produced, so much so that it destroys the cell and bursts out and then can go on to infect, quote, you know, infect in quotes, because that's not what actually happens, but that's what they say happens, another host. So that is what they say it is. But the problem is people get confused because they think of virology in terms of people getting sick, or two people in a household getting sick at the same time, or a PCR test, or antibody tests, all of these kind of peripheral phenomena that don't actually require the existence of viruses in the first place. So our job, or what we do, is we go back to every pivotal paper, whether it's SARS-CoV-2 or whether it's the first alleged virus to be discovered, which was the tobacco mosaic virus in the late 1800s. And we carefully read through these papers and see whether or not the methodologies are sufficient to come up with their conclusions, and universally they're not. So yeah, I think it's a great question, Tom, about what people think of viruses, because I think most people have this hazy conception in their mind where they're not actually thinking to look at the detail like we do of saying, where is the evidence of particles that result in more particles? It's a very simple concept, and yet you can go through all of the virology literature, all of its history, and you can't find that simple concept that doesn't exist. So that's a pivotal problem.
I guess one of the reasons that this is probably hard for some people to accept is that if what you're saying is true, I'm not saying it's impossible for it to be true. I'm just saying that there's a lot of screwiness in the world that needs to be accounted for. So for instance, there are antivirals, so-called. I'll take remdesivir because it's a particularly gruesome example, but remdesivir is billed as an antiviral. So presumably, the people who researched and developed it were operating on the presumption that viruses exist. But if viruses don't exist, what kind of research were they doing? How do they develop a, quote, antiviral if there's no viral? What does this thing do if it doesn't attack a virus?
Yeah, and we've certainly addressed that. And importantly, other groups have addressed this as well, including the Perth group, famously from the 1990s, has done extensive amounts of investigations and publications into HIV and the alleged antivirals that are used in the condition we know as AIDS. But yeah, so with things like remdesivir, they're not, none of them act against viruses. And this is part of the deception. So they use terms like antiviral when in fact they know by their own definition that, and I don't obviously agree that this is what happens, that they say this particle goes inside a host cell, such as a human cell, and uses the cell's equipment to make more copies of itself. So essentially, an antiviral just has to interfere with some process within the host cell. So they're not antivirals. They're just anti-metabolic agents, basically. Similar to, if you think of it, maybe the closest analogy would be chemotherapy. It's not attacking the cancer cell per se. It's an anti-metabolite. It's stopping processes from happening, slowing them down within the cell. It's interesting because this brings up drugs like ivermectin as well, which you're probably aware of, which has been promoted by many people in the health freedom community as a treatment for, quote, COVID-19. But we have the same problem here. They say it exhibits antiviral activity when that's not actually true. Because if you look at the papers, in vitro studies, so they're test tube type papers, studies, and essentially they look at something like the production of RNA. Now, they say that that RNA comes from a virus and that when they add the ivermectin to the test tube, there's less RNA produced. And therefore, they'll say the viral load, in quotes, is lower. But that's not actually what the studies show. Those kind of studies don't show the existence of infectious particles. They show various genetic sequences. They show various proteins. And we're not disputing that they exist. We know that they're in their samples that they have. But it's the interpretation. So saying that, oh, we added ivermectin to the test tube and then we saw less RNA being produced, therefore it must be an antiviral. But that relies on the premise that that RNA has been shown to come from inside one of these infectious particles. And there's nowhere in the literature where that is demonstrated. So I'm trying to simplify it as much as possible, but certainly let me know if there's something that needs to be more clearly explained.
Well, I guess the side of this that definitely has to be explored is, and I've, by the way, I've heard you discuss this interview after interview, and it must get tiresome after a while, but this is, I think, by and large, a brand new audience hearing this for the first time. So I hope you won't mind that we're treading over very old ground for you. But the subject of contagion has to be brought up because it seems like the most, if not obvious thing, then something we've taken for granted for so long that you don't go coughing on people or sneezing on people because you're going to make them sick. Or we think about the Black Death. It certainly seemed as if one person was giving it to another, was giving it to another. And a lot of times when there's a common cold in the, within the, a household, we say, well, dad gave me the cold, or mom gave me the cold, or uncle so-and-so came for a visit and he gave everybody a cold, stuff like that. If you're saying that there's no such thing as viruses, are you likewise saying that disease is not passed on from ordinary contact between one person and another?
Well, we have to tease things out here and be very specific about what we're talking about, because contagion specifically means the transmission of disease through a microbe. Now, that microbe can be something that we know exists, like bacteria, or fungal cells, or it can be an imaginary concept like viruses. But the point is that two people getting sick together or clusters of people getting sick in a particular area, that's different from the concept of contagion, which, as I say, involves specifically a microbe. Now, like all of this stuff with virology and germ theory, unlike Austrian economics, which, as we know, operates with a priori propositions and logical deductions, if we're doing microbiological experiments, we have to use the empirical process, specifically the scientific method. In other words, we come up with a hypothesis, in this case, that microbes are causing the transmission of disease between hosts. And then we design an experiment to test that hypothesis. And the experiment has to be done in such a way that it has appropriate controls, so it follows the scientific method. And we can isolate an independent variable, in this case, the microbe. So if you go back through history, and this is right back to Robert Koch and Louis Pasteur, and importantly with Robert Koch, Koch's postulates, which a lot of people are familiar with these days, a series of steps to show that it is the microbe and the microbe alone that causes transmission of disease. But you go back through every scientific paper designed to show this, none of them do. Not even Koch's original papers with TB. I mean, we looked at translations of his papers and they do not show that microbes by themselves transmit disease between hosts. And this is not unique to a couple of isolated examples. This is everything, whether we're talking about measles, chickenpox, whatever, tuberculosis, all of these conditions. In not one example do they have an experiment, a clinical experiment, which shows that using what they say is the isolated microbe results in transmission between two hosts. And it's the same with, even forget about the transmission element for a minute, this is even trying to infect a host. So taking things like pure cultures. So for instance, Tom, if they give you and I a pure culture of what they say is some sort of pathogenic bacteria, we take the bacteria by itself and fully purify it, it tends to do absolutely nothing. Unless you put it in ridiculously high concentrations or do something abnormal like inject it directly into someone. But if you use the natural transmission routes, which is, you know, inhalation, swallowing, skin contact, as I say, I mean, if anyone can show us one experiment, publication in history that's demonstrated this element of contagion, we'd be happy to review it. But I mean, at this stage, we've reviewed so many hundreds of them. I think it's fairly clear that contagion, germ theory, is not a thing. And it's really, really sad because in science, the word theory is supposed to be used when it has gone past the stage of being a hypothesis and it's been tested with controlled experiments numerous times, and every time it stood up to these challenges to the point where we say, well, this looks to be the correct model. But with things like germ theory and virology, this simply doesn't exist. They're not even close to being theories because they can only be called speculations if you actually apply the scientific model.
Can you say something about some research that I seem to recall being done surrounding the Spanish flu and trying to infect people?
Yeah, so famously in 1918, and again, Tom, this is, I wasn't taught this in medical school when they taught us about influenza. They just said, yes, it's a virus and this is what happens and these are the characteristics and this is how you treat it and these are the tests, etc. And what they omitted and what every single textbook on influenza seems to omit is that in 1918, they tried every possible way to transmit the Spanish flu. So famously, yeah, the Rosenau experiments in 1918, they took a whole lot of healthy volunteers. These were prisoners and they were offered the chance to participate in this experiment, the Spanish flu, with the bonus that they would be released early if they participated in the experiment. Now, keep in mind, this is supposedly one of the most deadly pandemics in history, but all of these fit, young, healthy guys were happy to line up and participate in the experiment. And what they had to do was they were exposed to other people who were extremely unwell with the so-called Spanish flu. And they had to do a variety of things. They had to lean in close and be coughed on, sneezed on. They had to deeply inhale the fetid exhalations coming out of these sick people. They even took mucus from sick people and shoved it straight up the noses and down the throats of the healthy volunteers. Sometimes they would take fluids from sick people and inject it directly into the healthy volunteers to see what would happen. And the results were pretty conclusive. They couldn't make anyone sick. Even being inside these wards full of people who were sick, none of the healthy volunteers who went in there became unwell. And since that time, there's been a number of other experiments attempting to transmit influenza, and they have similarly failed. So incredibly, that's where we are. Despite influenza textbooks and the CDC and all of these institutions around the world, we usually start by saying something like, influenza is caused by a virus that is highly contagious. And there is zero scientific evidence behind that. It's absolute fraud, front and center.
Oh boy, have I got follow-ups for this. Okay, in watching one of your interviews, I would say that maybe one of the weaknesses of your position, which doesn't weigh on whether viruses exist or not, but it does weigh on the question of, well, then what makes people sick? You said something along the lines of the obsession with viruses has distracted us from the more fundamental work of figuring out indeed what makes people sick. So the interviewer was asking you, we've all had experiences where somebody in the home comes down with a cold and we think, oh, here we go. Now all the kids are going to get it. I'm going to be up all night taking care of them. And sure enough, very often the kids do get it, or other people in the household do get it. Now, interestingly enough, not everybody gets it, which is odd because it seems like they should. If this theory is correct, everybody should get it. We're all breathing the same air. We're all interacting with each other, hugging, shaking hands, whatever it is. And only some people get it, but they do seem to get it. And so it seems like just on an anecdotal basis, we are inclined to think that we're passing it on to each other. So if that's not what's happening, then I think it's reasonable for us to ask what is happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the difficulty is for people to understand is that there are so many things that can make people sick, but there's only certain ways that the body can respond to these various insults. And even there are variations, of course, because when people say in a household that, oh, we've all just had the flu, if you actually talk to them, often they manifest in different ways, like dad had a terrible head cold and headache, and mum couldn't stop, her eyes and nose just kept watering or whatever. So there are different experiences too. But yeah, the thing is, there are definitely common exposures to things. So for instance, in a household or a particular area, there are so many things that those people share. Atmospheric conditions, change in weather, dietary factors, often common water sources that they're drinking. But not only that, there's also the psychological elements. So just being around other people. And I mean, we all saw that during the COVID era where people would behave in extremely strange ways, not because the particles transmitting between them, but because they're in a situation where they're incredibly stressed and can start manifesting physical symptoms just from psychological stress alone. So yeah, there's so many reasons why people get sick. And the difficulty is, Tom, is that, yeah, we'll get this in an email to Sam. We'll say, yeah, well, I've just watched your whole thing about influenza and I can see why it doesn't explain why I got sick in July 2021 and then Aunt Sue got sick as well at the same time. And I mean, it's a ridiculous kind of email because we'd need to know what specifically was happening for that person at that time. So often if you're able to go back through and find out exactly what's happening, you'll be able to identify a reason why that person got sick in the first place. But I mean, as you point out, one of the most important things is that we're not obliged to come up with reasons why everyone got sick, and whether it's alleged chicken pox or influenza or tuberculosis. The important thing is to show that the model of disease as being presented by the germ theorists and by the virologists is completely incorrect, and it's incorrect on their own terms. That's what's even worse here. and yet it's still being propagated as though this is factual and established. So, but yeah, Tom, also the other thing is obviously we don't have the benefit of tens of billions of dollars worth of funding that's pouring into these wrong theories, basically, or wrong hypotheses, we should say. So we're just all doing this, you know, with our internet platforms and discussion groups and forums and et cetera. We don't have access to the huge amount of research dollars that the other guys do.
But are you part of this? I'm trying to remember who I think is behind it, but are you part of this virus challenge where there's a challenge that's been laid out to virologists that we're going to ask you to do the following things, and if you can do them, then maybe that will demonstrate the truth of virology, but if not, then you have to consider that we may be right. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yep. So that's the settling the virus debate statement. And yeah, that's hosted on Sam's website, as well as on a couple of other people's websites, like Tom Cowan and Andy Kaufman. So this was, we basically issued sort of about the middle of last year, a two-page statement explaining why we think pathogenic viruses don't exist and basically some of the fundamental problems, like particularly that none of these particles have ever been found inside someone said to have a viral illness. And I think that's really important as well, Tom, because a lot of people don't understand that, that, you know, people think, well, if someone's got pneumonia and they cough up some bugs and we find the bugs in the Petri dish, yeah, that's evidence that the bug's causing a problem. Now that's not, and I can explain that another time about pneumonia. But with alleged viruses, they don't even find these particles inside people. So there's no difference between taking a well person and a sick person in terms of whether or not you can find viral particles in them. We know that in all of history, they can't find these particles in people who are said to be sick with these conditions. And we also know that the virologists don't do control experiments. And this is something that they can't get away from. And it's unbelievable that more people can't see this problem, that whether they're doing PCR or genomics or, quote, isolation experiments, they don't actually do controls. Or if they do, they're not valid controls. And we've detailed this in our extensive investigations. So the idea of the statement was just to say to them, hey, we don't think that you're following the scientific method. You're not doing proper controls. You're not doing blinded experiments, which are a requirement of the scientific method. So here's a series of experiments you could do in front of the world once and for all to show that your PCR, your genomics, and that your, quote, isolation in electron microscopy is valid on your own terms. Now, we don't think it's valid at all, but this was just an opportunity to the virologist to say, we'll let you do your usual techniques that you claim show the existence of viruses, but we'll just ask you to do it in a blinded fashion, and we'll ask you to do it with proper controls that we can actually all see. And no takers on that one, Tom.
Well, there's a surprise. Okay. Well, all right. But again, I have to, in a way, I feel like I'm asking an earlier question in a different way, but I still want to ask it. I don't think it's possible to know how many medical journal articles have been written about SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19, the disease that it's supposed to give rise to. I don't know how many, but surely it's in the thousands at this point. It's got to be. So the question then is, are you saying that every single researcher publishing a paper on this is chasing a phantom and not one of them notices that they're chasing a phantom? I mean, I'm willing to believe a lot about the health establishment at this point, but that does seem like rather a hard thing for us to, that even these people could be so thoroughly confused.
Yeah, no, well, it's not that amazing, I think, because for a start, anyone taking a dissident view would not be allowed to publish in a scientific journal. And this has been going on for decades now. So you may have heard of people like Peter Duisberg and the Perth Group, who have famously spoken out against the whole HIV/AIDS hypothesis. And I mean, they can't get anything published in a scientific journal. So we're looking at a completely lopsided framework here. And there's deeper issues going on with who actually runs the scientific journals and the vested interests. I mean, they've been corrupt for so many decades that you're not going to see any counter narrative in those journals. So yeah, essentially, Tom, if you start with the wrong premise. And you know the stuff from your studies of economics, is that the Austrians point out that if you start with faulty premises, everything that follows on is incorrect. None of it can be right. So the same problem applies here with virology. So if you look at any of these publications, they'll often start with something like SARS-CoV-2 was first isolated from Wuhan, China in 2019. And they'll link one of the, there are about five papers that came out relatively early on that purported to show the existence of SARS-CoV-2. And one of them, which I've been through extensively, sentence by sentence, I gave a breakdown of this in my essay I wrote last year, A Farewell to Virology. If you actually go through that paper and I demonstrate this, there's nowhere in that paper where they demonstrate that they have a virus. It's just, there's nowhere, basically. And yet that paper is now used as the starting point for all of these other papers. So if you typically read the first sentence in one of these virology papers that you're talking about, it will say this. It will say something about SARS-CoV-2, and that will just be the one-liner to say that it exists and here's the evidence, except the problem is that the evidence is simply not there.
Before I go on, let me say a quick thing that will help a lot of you, and you know who you are. If you are in business and you're getting buried by your competition online, then build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO, our great sponsor. If you're a small local business, you're trying to compete against large companies in the service industry, increase your visibility with Persist SEO. Or if you have low or no leads coming in on a consistent basis, well, website search engine and conversion optimization can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. If you're tired of cold calling, use your website as a lead generation engine. If you're not showing up for your services on the search engines, then get found with Persist SEO's expert search engine optimization. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help for a free website audit and consultation. That's 770-580-3736 or ineedseo.help. All right. If you study bears for a living, you are, I think, called an ursinologist. Okay. It's not a word that people use much, but that's what you are if you study bears. Now, it would be alarming and shocking to me to discover that 99% of the people who study bears are writing papers about the American black bear, and then discover that there is no such thing as an American black bear. So in other words, the entire profession is writing papers, and not one of them has said, by the way, there is no such thing as an American black bear. Or, by the way, there is. I'm just using that as an example. As far as I know, there is. I suppose the difference is that I can see a black bear with the naked eye, I suppose, and there's no series of presuppositions interfering with my ability to perceive the black bear. So that's not a good analogy. It's just shocking, though. I mean, to me, to a layman, even after 3 years of total nonsense being peddled at me, I just still find it hard to believe that this could be the case. But on the other hand, as you say, we are up against the old paradigm problem, the Thomas Kuhn problem, that when you have a, I hate using this type of pompous language, but when you have a reigning paradigm, virtually everybody is somehow within that paradigm. And if somebody is outside the paradigm trying to signal to them, it's almost like they can't even perceive or comprehend what it is you're trying to tell them. And what eventually happens in the development of science, it's not that very gradually, it's not like we get half virology and half non-virology. It's that all of a sudden, one paradigm simply fails and is suddenly and abruptly replaced by another paradigm. And I suppose you would say that kind of describes the situation today?
Yeah, well, your example with the bears is not too bad, because let's use another way of looking at it. So we know there are things that are bigger than these claimed viruses. So say bacteria, and we're all satisfied that they exist, and we can purify bacteria. We can culture them and get them by themselves and study them. We can work out their composition. We can watch them make more copies of themselves in the petri dish, all this kind of stuff. We have structures that are smaller than claimed viruses. So these would be things like proteins like insulin and albumin. So these are all things that we can find in the human body and satisfy ourselves that they do exist and they do have these particular physiological features and biochemical characteristics. We can do all that. But for some reason, right in the middle, we've got what they say are viruses. And yet, for some reason, they can't get purified samples of these things and they make up every excuse in the world and we respond to those criticisms. But the point is that these particular particles, they can't show that they exist. Now, people get confused because there are genetic sequences. Yes, there are proteins. Yes, there are things that they call antibodies, etc. But none of those things require the actual existence of these so-called infectious particles. And unfortunately, virology has resorted to pseudoscience, basically, by using these indirect measures and claiming that they are the definitive proof that these particles actually exist. But, you know, Tom, it's one of those things where people have got things wrong in the past, like really badly in history, and made fundamental errors with the natural world. And this is one of them. But there are various reasons for that. And if the whole virus and contagion model falls apart, I'm sure you can imagine that the world we'd live in would be completely different. Institutions like the CDC, for instance, would have no function anymore. All of these public health measures that they try and put in place, whether it be restrictions on what we can do, face masks, vaccines, pharmaceuticals, the whole thing just falls apart. And I think we know, like, within the last 3 years, a lot of people within the freedom community think that they're subject to censorship. And that's true to a certain extent. If they're talking about PCR test or social distancing, face masks, all of these things, by far, and we know this from my wife Sam's platforms and the algorithms, that mentioning no virus is the way to get completely shadow banned and to get all of your work shut down within seconds, sometimes minutes. So to give you an example, last year, Sam made a video about polio, and we thought because it wasn't about COVID-19, we might be able to put something back on her YouTube channel. She's got a pretty big YouTube channel, but we can't usually post anything on it. And a video about polio, pointing out the science behind it, got struck down after 6 minutes. And this is what we face, basically all of us in the no virus community, is that, and this maybe this is why it's taken you a while to actually hear this argument, is that the level of censorship we face is so heavy, it's unbelievable. And people have to ask why.
Well, I'm not going to be posting this episode on YouTube. But of course, as you know, since there's no camera involved, up to now, my YouTube episodes are really just a still shot and then the audio. So most people don't listen on YouTube anyway. But I'll make up for those listeners because I will send an email to my mailing list about this episode. And a lot of people who don't ordinarily listen will click and listen in. So I'll make up for that. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. And I have this crazy view that adults should be able to discuss even controversial things freely. You know, I had no idea it was such an extreme view, but according to the powers that be, it is. Now, your position on viruses does not commit you to any particular positive health regimen because they have nothing to do with each other. You're not saying that simply because you take this view on viruses that therefore you believe that such and such home remedy will cure people. That has nothing to do with it. I mean, you might have your own private opinions on that, but they don't follow from your opinions on virology. So anybody coming along saying, well, I've tried some of these natural remedies, they don't work, has nothing strictly to do with what you're saying. And likewise, whether or not you have an explanation as to what made people sick over the past couple of years, or whether something made people sick, has nothing strictly to do with your thesis on the existence of viruses. However, having stated all that, and acknowledging that a lot of these so-called COVID deaths, that people say they were coded wrong, or they overstated the number, let's even leave that all aside. It looks as if some people did get sick with something quite intensely over the past couple of years. And it does look as if we can look across the world and see this spreading across the world. It does seem as if something happened. But if you're saying it's not the spread of a virus known as SARS-CoV-2, then, you know, again, I realize that this is not necessarily what you're obligated to give us. What is your best guess as to, in your paradigm, what is likely to have happened?
Well, in terms of organically, I think nothing happened. The apparent spread was mainly related to how they came up with their case numbers. And that's, if you look at the definition of COVID-19, and this is another issue that we've dealt with extensively, what is the actual diagnostic criteria of COVID-19? If you go to the WHO website, it says that a confirmed case is based on one of the molecular detection assays. So these in vitro assays, whether it's PCR or later on it became the antigen test. But by mid-2020, the Cochrane collaboration did a meta-analysis, and their conclusion was that there were no specific signs or symptoms of this alleged new disease, COVID-19. Everything was based on the molecular detection test. But as I've talked about extensively, we've covered this in many of our videos and articles, those tests don't require a clinical condition, and they certainly don't require the presence of a virus. They just require reactions with nucleic acids or proteins, which we know are present everywhere. And this is why you saw the crazy stuff like pawpaws and goats and motor oil could all test positive. And it's important to distinguish too, and I won't get into it here because we'll probably get out of time, about how medical tests actually work and the differences between analytical parameters, which is how they perform in the lab, if you want to say, versus the diagnostic parameters, which is how they're supposed to be validated to diagnose an actual condition. And to cut to the chase, with regard to COVID-19, there's no test that's been clinically validated ever. So when people talk about COVID-19, they're not actually talking about a specific entity. And this has been the whole fraud. We didn't have a disease pandemic. We had a testing pandemic. And wherever the tests went, the cases appeared. Now, you've got to also remember, Tom, that yeah, definitely in countries such as the United States and England, there were excess deaths apparently in 2020. But you got to look around the rest of the world and say, in most countries, we didn't have this pattern, that nothing at all happened. And that's weird in itself, that you can have countries that are adjacent to one another, with one apparently having a surge in deaths, and right next door, the country having no excess mortality. And we certainly did an analysis of this. It's kind of a peripheral issue because it doesn't get to the heart of virological science. But if you've got two countries that are adjacent to each other and both allegedly are in pandemic and one's got excess mortality and one hasn't, I think you have to look at other explanations, and many people have looked into this, which is such as what is the reaction to this alleged situation and what are the treatment protocols being put in place? And many of us were horrified when we looked at places like New York to see how they were actually treating people with these most aggressive and bizarre protocols that were completely unnecessary. So potentially, well, definitely we were just dealing with the same types of illnesses. There was no novel illness that appeared in 2020, but we were just seeing different reactions to it. And some of those reactions were absolutely appalling. Whether, as I say, it was the aggressive approach in North America, which seemed to relate a lot to how much money practitioners could get by coding the disease as, quote, COVID-19. Versus what happened in the UK, which looked like a lot of neglect for elderly people, including protocols involving sedatives, which obviously are incredibly dangerous for elderly people. So yeah, I think we talked about this way back in 2020, and Sam's co-author, Dr. Klaus Kuhnlein in Germany, explained that what we were witnessing was a PCR pandemic. What was new was the PCR. And what was new was this absolute panic that there was some new condition going around. But again, I think, Tom, it gets so distracted when people start saying, well, what happened in Northern Italy and what happened in this region? And we need all of the information from those regions to say, how were things being diagnosed? What were the protocols that were being in place, et cetera, rather than just looking at these overall pictures and trying to come up with these specific explanations. So our job was to look at the basic science and say, is there evidence for a new disease? No. Is there evidence that an infectious particle is passing around? No. Is there evidence that any of these so-called tests have been clinically validated? No. And that's for us, which is where we basically hand it over and say, this is not the explanation.
Somebody like Dr. Peter McCullough, who would agree with you on some things regarding the COVID response and no doubt about the shots. Nevertheless, he's known for the McCullough protocol to treat COVID-19. And I would say Dr. McCullough is generally within the realm that we would call the health freedom movement. So he's developed this protocol that he published early on. So have you looked into that? And is there any merit to that? Does any of that help make people better? I'm just wondering, can you find any merit in the kind of work he does?
Yeah, no, I know Peter's work well. And the problem is that, and I know Peter's been challenged on this from members of the no virus team, if you like, and he doesn't really have satisfactory answers to the virological questions. But we're talking about different things here. I mean, I would just say to Peter, how does he diagnose COVID-19? Because it will come back to a PCR or an antigen assay or an antibody assay. And I would just ask Peter to show me, where was that clinically validated? How do you know what that diagnosis? Because that's never been done. So whatever treatment protocols he's doing, it doesn't relate to a specific disease entity. Now, he may be having some good results with his protocols, but once again, we would just say that that's not proof that there's a quote virus or a new disease. So they're kind of separate issues. And unfortunately, with Peter, I have seen some of his claims that viruses exist. And unfortunately, he deals with it at such a basic level. Like, for instance, last year, he presented electron microscopy images and said that was proof that viruses exist because there are some vesicles in the image. Now, I mean, that is, we've blown this stuff apart for years. I mean, Sam has a really good video that the audience could understand about electron microscopy, just explaining why that methodology is not sufficient to show that you have infectious particles. But again, we've found this a frustration, Tom, of trying to engage with other health freedom people like Peter McCullough and many others, but they can't seem to get past the fundamental flaws of virology, and they accept these premises. And it's amazing to us because they know that these public health officials and the epidemiologists and various other doctors around the world and scientists are lying, basically. But then they accept the virologists on face value and don't actually do a deep dive into the work that they're doing to see that that's as flawed as any of it, if not worse.
Well, what I'm going to do is on the show notes page for today, so it's episode 2282, so it's tomwoods.com/2282, I'm going to link to a few things. I'm going to link, first of all, to your wife's site, drsambailey.com. Then you have a page that you use a redirect for that goes to your information, drmarkbailey.net. And then I'm also going to link directly, even though people can find it there, I'll still link directly to your Farewell to Virology piece that you wrote. People can look at it for themselves. And again, if somebody's listening and thinks, I have a really strong background in this, and I think there are some things that are being overlooked, I will welcome you. You know, I'm not hard to find online. Okay. It's not difficult to find tomwoods.com and contact me, and we'll set it up. But the deal has to be that since I've had other debates on the Tom Woods Show that, as longtime listeners will recall, have all been entirely civil, it would have to be civil. If there's any name calling or whatever, then we just call it a day and Mark is declared officially the winner. So in any event, Mark, I appreciate your time. I love how we were able to coordinate, even though you're 18 hours ahead. I hope, let's see, so what does that make you? It's February 10th where you are?
Yeah, that's correct. Yep.
I hope February 10th is going well, because so far February 9th is okay over here where I am. Hope February 10th is going well for you. And I hope people with an open mind will take a look at what you're saying. And at the very least, we can get a good, robust conversation going. So thanks again, Mark.
Tom, that'd be fantastic. Yeah, if someone wants to come on and have a conversation with me, we'd be more than happy to. But as you pointed out, they'd probably be best to read A Farewell to Virology first, because it's a very extensive refutation of the virus model, and it will probably answer many of their questions.
Okay, good. So again, the place to go to get all these links, very simply, tomwoods.com/2282. Thank you, Mark.
Tom, thank you very much.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.